We can come back order, please. Good morning. Patricia, can you give us the safety briefing, please?
Yes. Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. Please silence any noise-making devices that you have at this time. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in the front of the room. Then the first door on your left, moving east towards the grassy area along Jefferson. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Okay, our first item of business this morning is to look at May's meeting minutes. Do I have any, does anybody have any suggestions for editing the minutes?
I guess I better get the microphone so people can hear me.
Then can I have a motion, please?
I'll motion.
Thank you. Board Member Smith? She's going to get something up.
I was going to say, am I winging it here? Okay.
You could read it, please.
I move the Forest Practices Board to the May 11th, 2016 meeting minutes.
Do I have a second, please?
Second.
Thank you, Board Member Jackie. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Same sign. Any abstentions?
I'll abstain.
I abstain as well.
Because I wasn't there.
Yeah. Got it. Three abstentions.
Four.
Four abstentions. Are we there?
We win!
Who's the third?
It's remember Little Herrera, Lori, and Sweetie.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to spend a couple of minutes. Did I say going past? Thank you. So I wanted to take a few minutes to just talk about some other things that are going on that I thought I'd inform you about. First of all, we don't have a cultural resource agenda item today. However, I wanted to make sure that the board members were aware that that issue is moving forward. You'll find in your day of packet a letter from Tim Thompson, the consultant that DNR has hired. Facilitate moving this issue forward, and we're hoping that a first of several meetings actually occur towards the end of this month and between forest landowners, the state, and the tribes to better communicate and educate concerning cultural resources, the need to improve existing cultural resource processes, and commit to come together in good faith to seek a mutually agreeable outcome. So I just want to give you an update that that is moving forward, and in November we'll have more information on that for you. Second, you may have heard around August 4th, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service affirmed the current critical habitat designations for marbled murrelet. Bottom line is there's no change and therefore not necessary at this time for the board to take any action. So I'm going to make you aware of that. Third item I wanted to bring up is we've been looking for an opportunity to take you out again for a field tour this fall. And what I will be proposing is that we make the November meeting a two-day affair where we would actually do a field tour on the first day, actually on election day, so please mail in your ballots before you come to the meeting. And then the second day we would have our regular board meeting, and this would all be held in the Caldwell area. so.
And so that's Tuesday, Wednesday, that week?
That's a Tuesday, Wednesday. We would probably organize vans and take the board and staff over Monday afternoon, evening, and then get started bright and early Tuesday for the field tour, and then have a board meeting on Wednesday, and then return Wednesday afternoon, evening. Fourth item that I wanted to bring to your attention is we are, as I mentioned at the last board meeting in May, we're in the process of getting the questions ready for the independent science peer review process of the compliance monitoring report. And however, it's likely to be February before we get a final report from staff on how that all went. And I wanted to remind everybody that, the Forest and Fish report was negotiated and codified in law in 1999, and that resulted in the HCP being approved 10 years ago. So I'm hoping to have cake after lunch for us, for everybody who's in attendance, not just board members. So in a celebration of the HCP being 10 years old. Anyway, that's all I have. So with that, Patricia, do you have the list for public comment, please? Maybe that'll help with the sugar low right after lunch as we head into the water. Okay, I have two members of the public signed up for the morning public comment period, and I'll just remind everybody that this general public comment period is for general things on the board that are of interest to the board, and that we'll have public comment periods before the board takes action on specific things. So, the first person, please, John Pencelli. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, sir.
Come on up. If you could please state your name for the record and whether you represent anybody or yourself, and then dive in.
Good morning to everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is John Pencelli. I am representing the residents of East Squim and the Gardner community. I started attending Department of Natural Resources meetings over 2 years ago with concerns over Blinder Peter timber sale number 90790. I showed evidence of murrelet existence. I showed evidence that sale was going to damage marble murrelet habitat, potential spotted owl habitat. All of the adjustments that were promised to us, not one of them was implemented. The gate that was supposed to be put in was 4 months late. They've done dynamite blasting that was not permitted or listed as part of the sale. In April, I watched the marble murrelet that I've watched for 10, 15 years scatter as they started dropping giant trees 45 inches in diameter and larger to make room for the log landings, that we showed evidence that they should have moved and made adjustments for. It worked in 1936 for them to harvest and not impact those trees in those spaces, but for some reason they couldn't do it this time. This morning I woke up at 5 a.m. to chainsaws running. They're not supposed to work before 6. I was able to stop the loggers from wrapping a cable around the tree that houses marbled murrelet. The only hope for those birds to come back after the logging operation is for those trees with the blue band around them to exist. At this point in time, that tree is going to get a cable wrapped around it, and the tree at the top, tree number 6, to give it a number, has got probably 40 tons of log stacks laying on her root system. I have in writing signed commitments from regional managers and foresters that these things would be implemented, including protecting pileated woodpecker habitat and sign statement that says that they would not harvest any active pileated habitat. I have photographic proof that they dropped that pileated woodpecker nest with juveniles in the nest on its face. The only reason why those birds are alive is because of the Northwest Raptor Center and a crew of volunteers that stayed in the forest for 21 days, 24 hours a day, defending those juvenile pileated woodpeckers from raccoons, coyotes, and bobcats. I have to leave here immediately to get back into the forest to stop those loggers from committing infractions. And they're the ones who are gonna have to face the infraction. They don't know what I'm talking about. Nobody ever informed them of anything. Keeping in mind, I'm a fourth generation logger. The money that went into my gas tank to bring me here was earned running a chainsaw, not logging anymore, but correcting the mistakes of improperly designed logging units, both private and on DNR lands. There will be a great outcry in the next 2 weeks coming to the Forest Practices Board and to the Department of Natural Resources from my community. If people don't think I'm having an impact, not to be sarcastic, but you can look at the fact that Jim McIntyre is no longer on the Board of Natural Resources. And I know for a fact, and I can prove, that him not standing up for our community and the Blinder Peter timber sale, not to be stopped, not to take away any timber jobs, but to be modified. Him not doing so, I guarantee you, was greatly impactful in his election. We have a great community outcry coming, and I will be glad to be the liaison or the communicator with my community, just like I did with the department. But we're not backing down. We're real upset. And when I get home, there's probably gonna be 25, 30 people up there in that forest, filming and documenting. Well, we told that the Board of Natural Resources was going to occur. We were ignored. Thank you very much for your time. I am greatly, greatly appreciative of the work that you all do. But something's got to change. We talk about compliance. I challenge, I don't ask. I asked nicely for 2 years. I challenge any one of you on this board to come to 1634 Chicken Coop Road and take a tour. You guys take field tours, you guys can come on to my house and see the destruction in my backyard that I forecasted years ago was gonna happen and didn't happen. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Steve? Or you can say if you want to, but so this is a DNR timber sale, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And so from a forest practice board perspective, I think it's good for us to remember, for you to remind us that even though DNR has a habitat conservation plan, even forest practice rules require them to be in compliance with their habitat conservation plan in order to be in compliance with the forest practice rules.
And I can show you direct violations of that conservation plan and direct contradictions from the forest, the unit forester that is making biologist decisions. And one quote to be direct is that, there shouldn't be any concerns about the towns and big-eared bat, for they do not live in the forest. They live and exist due to man-made structures. That's your forester making a decision when we prove that there's a massive towns and big-eared bat nursery right in the center of Unit 2 and giant stump. All we wanted was that stump, zero value, protected. They said that they don't have to do it because Townsends don't live in the forest. You guys want to come out on that field trip, I'll prove it.
Thank you. Ken Miller, please.
I didn't know we were going to have a party today to celebrate the HCP signing at our tree farm 10 years ago.
Exactly, Ken.
Down in my camp.
I'm sure that you can provide us with some memories.
Yeah. I should have worn my little button. Welcome to our tree farm. Chairman Bernath and members of the board, I'm Ken Miller, representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association, and a persistent advocate for altering the harvest prescriptions forest and fish required to be available to small forest landowners. Once again, I'm inviting the board to visit our tree farm in Olympia so you can at least get a visual impression of the West Side template proposal. A proposal that seemingly continues to languish in the adaptive management program without a clear pathway back to you anytime soon. Without involving yourselves in the adaptive management process, it's important to thousands of small forest landowners that you show an interest with a visit to a demonstration site, as you have with other critical issues and important constituents. On a different note, I'd like to remind the board that Smalls have volunteered to serve on the DNR Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee for many years without even reimbursement for actual expenses. We report to and advise the Small Forest Landowner Office of DNR, not the board. But I'd like to remind the board that RCW 76.09.368 does direct the board to consult with the Small Forest Landowner Office Advisory Committee in developing alternate approaches. Excuse me. So please try to imagine what it's like to serve on such an advisory board for over 10 years and never be asked for advice from the board, or rarely be asked for advice from DNR, even when changing forms or instructions where our advice could potentially help small forest landowner understanding of complex rules, hopefully resulting in greater compliance. How are we expected to find replacement volunteers, especially from the east side, without even travel expenses, or when their advice is rarely sought? To end on a positive note, I proudly acknowledge that WDFW has come to the committee a couple of times in recent years asking for our advice on better ways to involve Smalls in issues and opportunities with the gray squirrel and the fisher. I hope our advice was of some value to Terry and others at WDFW. I know that being asked was appreciated by myself and other landowners on the committee. I felt respected and by the request for help. And I also felt a ray of hope for the collaborative spirit that was the foundation of Forest and Fish. Thank you very much. I hope you do give some time to small forest landowners who do own nearly half of Washington's private forest land. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. All right, moving on. If Mark Hicks would approach the...
Excuse me?
Yes. Board members or...
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. The gentleman that spoke just before, Mr. Miller, I guess I've been on the board for a couple of years now, and I haven't heard specific testimony about specific sales, and I'm not, it feels awkward to just sit here and stare at people who drive down from a long ways and have specific concerns, and so I'm not certain what our options are or you know, what the to-do is as a result of that. Will we hear back some kind of report as to what is going on, or is it out of our purview, or I mean I'm not sure what to do with that, but the silence, it doesn't feel good to me.
So in the background, I've asked staff to talk to the person and get the information and follow up.
So,
board member Sweeting.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was concerned by that testimony, especially since if I understood what he was saying correctly, that an actual occupied stand was being harvested, which would not be good. So getting accurate information about what the situation was and what happened would be appreciated.
Absolutely. Okay. Mark, so for the board members, if you recall, the initial Clean Water Act assurances that were agreed to when the HCP and the Forest and Fish Report came into being in 1999 was to provide about 10 years to see whether the prescriptions that were agreed to at the time, the rules that were adopted in 2001, were working for clean water purposes. Ecology found there was not enough information coming out of the adaptive management process to tell whether the current prescriptions were working or not. Ecology identified some operational and SEMR milestones that needed to be attended to. And as you heard at the last board meeting, there was some concerns identified by Mark regarding the current report, and we committed to, I committed my staff to working with Ecology for the last 3 months to address some of those concerns. So Mark is here today to tell us how we're doing.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman Brown. Yeah. And for the record, I'm Mark Hicks. I work with the Department of Ecology, and I'm responsible for overseeing the implementation of the Clean Water Act corrected milestones. Thank you for the background. That's it. I can skip the first few paragraphs. And since your last meeting, actually, and I really do appreciate you volunteering your staff to step forward and work with Ecology to look at what can be done to help actually extinguish the remaining DNR-based milestones. I think we had a very productive conversation, and I think it resulted in some possible improvements that I think will pay benefits moving forward. And some of those are DNR operations has committed to strengthen the cooperative approach that's used to engage the compliance monitoring program stakeholder advisory group to ensure that the 2014 guidance that was issued on reviewing alternate plans is being used effectively across the state. To ensure that the regional water type review team process is still up and functional and is doing the job it was intended to do. As well as to expand the small forest landowner road survey more statewide. So those are all positive steps forward, I believe. In addition,
excuse me, Mark, is that reflected in your report?
I believe it is. Things?
Okay.
Yes. So I'm trying to keep the same format as in the past. So you should see red font that shows new information or changes. And so if you look at the individual milestones, you should see some notes in there in red for each one of them that will say exactly what, well, approximately the same information that I'm giving to you. I hope that's what you thought. You got that quizzical look on your face.
No.
Okay. All right. So then we also met with Hans Verge, the Adaptive Management Program Administrator. And Hans has committed to review and revise as needed the existing process used to flag SEMR projects that are having trouble with moving forward with the purpose of trying to then intervene in the appropriate manner, depending on what the issue is, to try to get the corrections made at the soonest possible time. In addition, Hans has assigned one of his SEMR project managers, actually the only one at this moment in time, they have to do some more hiring, Howard Hammerly, will begin a process to re-examine our existing lean process, the changes we've been making, to see what's been working, what hasn't been working, and make some fine-tuning adjustments to that or whatever is needed to make it effective. And so again, those are also really positive changes because we often get tied up in our process. And as soon as we establish a process in the adaptive management program, we realize where it's working and where it isn't. And we need to actually use adaptive management to just adjust our process. Okay, since your May meeting, the TFW Policy Committee has completed one milestone and affected progress on a couple others. The one that they completed was that policy took the time to look over its rather lengthy task list of possible issues it needed to address, and then reprioritized it, and then institutionalized the review of that as new issues come up. So as any new issues come up, it'll be looked at in the context of all the other ones that they said were, you know, very important to the program's success and health. So that's a good thing. Policy also took the step of discussing the mass wasting landscape scale monitoring project that had been omitted from the master project schedule. It's a Clean Water Act milestone that was not on the list. And they reaffirmed the importance of the underlying question and put the study back on the project list by providing money in the 2019 budget to assess project feasibility. There are some questions on whether this project can actually be done. And so the first step is to actually do a feasibility assessment to find out, to try to actually make that call. Is there a defensible way to assess the different rates of landslides on managed and unmanaged lands? So that's the underlying question. Money was also placed in the budget for 2019 to begin scoping a study to examine the effect of forestry on amphibians and intermittent streams. This exists as a Clean Water Act milestone with a caveat that it would begin at the end of the hard rock study, which should inform the need for this additional study. So we don't, there may be sufficient information from the hard rock study to negate the need to move forward or to indicate that this would not be a productive use of research dollars. So it's followed, the milestone was as soon as the hard rock study was completed, they would begin scoping if necessary this study. There's a slight delay only beyond when the hard rock study will be completed by approximately a year, and that was necessary for policy to balance the budget, essentially.
Do you want to, since we have new board members, you want to, you're short cutting, you know, hard rock?
Oh, sorry.
Remind people what that is.
There is a very large study moving through the adaptive management program. It's still within the CEMA research program that examines the effectiveness of the rules applied to non-fish bearing streams for basalt lithologies on the west side of the state. There's a companion study that is a soft rock study, so you might hear that short name as well. And that's for the more erodible lithologies, and it's moving through CEMA as well at this point in time. The hard rock study is an effectiveness study. It tests the rules, and it tests the rules in terms of whether the rules are protecting water quality as well as amphibians. It's the amphibian component that's really important in this case to this conversation about the intermittent stream part of the study. They are in that study that includes some reaches that do cease to flow periodically. And it was kind of hoped that there'd be enough information gained from that study to inform whether we had to do a more in-depth analysis. That helped.
Thank you.
You'll be hearing a lot about the hard rock study in the next year. I'll just add, it's probably it'll be approximately a 1,000-page report with 17 chapters. Each chapter functions almost like an independent research project. That's slowly moving its way through ISPR right now. The last remaining chapter should be approved in not too long distant future. You probably got an update, it has specific dates on it, but this next year it should actually get a formal approval and finalization. It'll be fed piece by piece to policy to review because it's so large, and CEMA and policy will work together to figure out how to best do that. Once that's completed and the findings report has been amassed and agreed to, it would be brought to the board. So during this period, speaking of CEMA, no CEMA research milestones have been completed. So some things worth note, however, is that UPSAG, the Upland Processes Science Advisory Group, has taken over the work that was previously started under a TWIG, a technical working group. To design a criteria set of rule of, sorry, it's actually hard not to use the acronym, the RIL criteria evaluation project. So the criteria that are used to define what might be an unstable slope, are those really effective as they're written? There was some hint that they may not be in a prior study, a mass wasting effectiveness monitoring study, which has been completed and has been shared with the board. And so a second study was going to go back in and follow up and see whether some refinements might need to be made. So the adaptive management program funded and then put together a technical working group to begin that scoping effort. That group essentially kind of fell apart. And UPSAG has reformed. It also had kind of fell apart for a little while. It's back and it's taken on this project, and the intention is to move a best available science review and alternatives analysis forward this fall to at least CEMA and maybe policy. So that's good progress being made. Not so much progress on the NREP study, the Eastern Washington Type N Effectiveness Monitoring Project. So when we spoke last, this was the project that was highlighted as concern. It was in dispute. The dispute was on some process issues for the most part. The initial dispute seemed to have been resolved, and that allowed the project to move essentially more into a review of the technical issues. It is now back in dispute. Different people, different issues. Some of those are technical, and some of those appear not to be. But anyway, so it's moved back into dispute, and CMR will need to follow its existing process again to try to work its way through these remaining issues.
And if I recall, that study was actually, if it hadn't been in dispute, it would have been actually hitting the field this summer. Is that correct? Or am I?
It has a long sordid history. It actually, the project actually began in 2009 in the East Side Science Advisory Group. Charters were formed, scoping documents developed. Then, for various reasons, it would take too much time. We ended up deciding to move it to these brand new concept of a TWIG, the Technical Working Group, Technical Writing and Implementation Group. And then that process got stalled out too. So this has been an unfortunate series of events. But it should be in the field. It actually should be as far along as the Soft Rock study, which is in its beginning its it's finishing up its first post-harvest year. So it's well behind schedule. And the fact that it's still locked up in dispute over issues such as what it's supposed to be testing is pretty disappointing to a college. So when it brought what was kind of sour news, I guess, last board meeting, at least it was taken that way, by a lot of people. One of the issues is, what would you do? What recommendations does ecology have to fix things beyond the milestones themselves? And hopefully in your packet you have one pager, I believe, on ecology suggestions for further improvements or refinements to the adaptive management process. And these are not earth-shaking. We've talked about these, or we're actually starting to move this way already within the adaptive management program. But I thought it'd be worth sharing. So the first one is to get more help from outside experts. So we actually have a milestone for this, but we should complete the milestone directing that a process audit be commissioned to examine the adaptive management program and how it works.
Well, note, we actually had this on the state auditor's list of things to do. It must have been a while ago now. For whatever reason, the auditor chose not to pick this. So I think with a new auditor coming on board this January, we have a new opportunity to ask them to focus on this.
Yeah, that would be great. I believe they had other priorities that came in all of a sudden, if I remember right. So then also make greater use of independent contractors to complete discrete project components. We're already doing that. We could probably do that more and be more effective. Further lean the process. We've been trying, obviously. Some things work, some things don't. And you don't know until you try it. So A, tighten up the timelines for project review. Task the AMPA with improving the process for identifying projects that are having problems. I mentioned this a little earlier, it's kind of already an agreement that we have. So trying to actually realize that there is problems as quick as possible and then seek those solutions that'll avoid things sitting on the shelf for 5 or 6 months while people just kind of talk past each other. Require consensus to allow any step in the process to be reversed once an agreement has been made, or when issues once in consensus are being raised later as a point of objection. This happens too often. We have a very lengthy process. It's fairly formal. It takes a while. Everybody agonizes over it, but then people often reverse course at the end, or new people come in and back it up. And that's costing us sometimes years.
So you're saying...
Board member Lowry.
Having a higher standard for reversing a step.
Once it's been made in consensus.
Once it's been made in consensus, make sure that that's...
It requires consensus then to back up again. You never want to stop a conversation. There can be very good reasons and good information that's brought to the table to reverse the decision. It just should be based on consensus at that point.
And that's something that you could, CEMER itself could consider, and that's how it does business, correct?
I believe so. Get formal upfront time commitments from members of the TWIGs or the SAG, the science advisory groups, that are leading projects, and establish a protocol for replacing them if they're unable to fulfill their commitments. So we always appreciate the fact that this is a really volunteer-based system for the most part. But it's difficult when a project is essentially held hostage to someone's outside schedule for very long periods of time. I've experienced a situation where you invite people into the program from the outside and you explain what the time frame is for developing a project, but then you include other folks maybe from within the process who then don't meet when it's time to meet and extend that timeline beyond what the original agreements were and what the original intention of the lien process is. So it seems worth looking at making some clear, being really clear about what the commitments are. We're expecting, you know, 4 meetings within a 5-month period, and then this will be the product that will be developed. Those types of commitments. And particularly when we're inviting people that have full-time jobs elsewhere, sometimes out of the country even, I think BC's out of our country, we really do need to have something that we can hold ourselves to when we've asked them to participate, so it isn't an ongoing ask. Make better use of CEMER's guided decision-making process to resolve disagreements in an expedient fashion. I think I got to experience this a little bit recently with the first dispute that was filed on that NREP study, where more energy went into a concern that a dispute had been filed than went into trying to resolve the issue. That doesn't make sense. We put together this process with all its steps in order to actually work through disagreements. It isn't a failure of the program, and it isn't some sort of a catastrophic conflict between stakeholders to disagree. People disagree all the time. We've set up a formal process to walk through those disagreements and resolve them, to categorize them into the right bins, and resolve them in different ways depending on what bin they go in. But we have to actually use it. Not be ashamed or feel like somehow people are acting badly if they call a dispute. Keep policy and the science decisions separate. And this is just probably time to revisit whether the CEMER policy firewall is working well enough. It can never be an absolute brick wall. We all know there's a gray area between science and policy, and that there's a necessity for people to understand where their stakeholders are, where their caucuses are in terms of the science as well. But at this point, the system doesn't seem to be working very well when policy gets too deep into the science and starts to redesign the studies, or CEMER representatives are essentially trying to represent the policy decisions that their policy representatives should be taking to the table. So they both are taking each other's hats too much, and I think that ties it up. So we have decisions made in policy that seem to be essentially disagreed with on a policy basis in CEMER sometimes, and we have decisions made in CEMER that are science-based that are disagreed with in policy on technical basis. So I think we need to look at whether that is happening too much to a level that's not effective and healthy.
Would that be part of the audit?
I think it would. Ultimately, I think an auditor probably would. If they're asking members of the group, both policy and CEMER, I think that they would. Then have policy follow through with their earlier commitments, years now have passed, to review and agree on project purposes and prioritize their information needs for CEMER research projects well before they're scoped. We often end up with people trying to figure out what they want the project to do after we've already assembled the team. And so the argument is what policy really intends the project to do, what questions they really need answers to. And it would help to actually do that up front as part of our annual review of the CEMER work plan. That's a good time. That's what we talked about before. Then we take the projects that are likely to come in the near future, and we put some more emphasis in policy on those particular projects to make sure that it was clear right from the start what the intent was, what the necessary information policy would need to make it actionable. So I think those are some possible improvements that, we could at least look into and possibly make that would help.
Thank you, Mark.
Any questions?
Questions from board members? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, we're going to go on to our 10:30 item. Hey, we're almost on the head here. So Hans is going to come up, and while he's coming up, so if you all recall, one of the outcomes of the settlement agreement between forest landowners, the state, and the Conservation Caucus several years ago, and the resulting rule changes recommended by TFW policy was that on budget, what I call budget prep years, that's basically even numbered years in the state budgeting process, TFW would recommend what was needed to move forward with the adaptive management program for use in budget preparation for the upcoming legislative session. The updated master project schedule that we received and the estimated budget of what will be needed to implement that schedule is therefore being presented to you by Hans. And next spring, just so that you get the complete picture, which will be the odd number here, legislature is supposed to make budgetary decisions, and then policies, CMER and policy will bring us recommendations on how to actually spend the money that gets allocated once the legislative session has completed. In addition to that, and once he's gone through the, given us a lowdown on the project schedule and estimated budget, there's an outline. We actually have a legislative report due to the legislature this fall. And we have an outline in your day of packet to show you, and he'll go through that and we'll have a discussion about that. Hans?
Good morning, Chairman Burnett, members of the Forest Practices Board. I'm Hans Burge. I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator. And as Chairman Burnett just pointed out, I'm going to be talking to you about the 17-19 proposed budget for the Adaptive Management Program. I'll go ahead and walk you through the main items on the budget and make sure that if there are any questions that you have, that there's adequate time to, address those. So the first point out of the gate is, we're still in the 15-17 biennium. We're in the middle of it, and we have projected spending through fiscal year 2017. We just had that approved at the May meeting, and so there are a number of items in this proposed budget that are the next phases of those projects, and so you see a lot of names in this list that look familiar because we just talked about many of them in the discussion about the fiscal year 2017 that we're now in. So that's an important thing to, recognize here. And so I'm just going to walk through the main headings in the budget. The headings are highlighted in red, and then there's a list of items down the rows, and then another red, and so forth. And so I'll start with the administrative and support staff. Those are rows 7 through 14. These are the operations that are necessary to keep things moving. The top of the list there is program administration. My position as the Adaptive Management Program Administrator and our contract specialist are listed there in row 7. Then we get to project support, which are project managers. Then we have CMER staff scientists that are housed at the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, and they're the backbone of CMER. They are really doing the work behind the scenes on behalf of CMER to make sure that the projects move forward along with the other participants and stakeholders. Then we get into the contingency fund for active projects, and those funds are really identified to help support any unforeseen circumstances that may crop up. And those are, we've had to tap into those in the past, and it's very advantageous to have access to those in real time as things evolve and unforeseen circumstances happen. Then we get into the TFW policy facilitation. So the policy committee meetings, we have a facilitation and organization contract with a contractor that helps policy run. You've all probably been aware of that. It's been happening for several years, and it's been very effective with different aspects of policy and getting to decisions. Then we have our CEMA conference. That's just a standard thing we do every 2 years. We were all invited to that in February 2015. And then board priorities, row 13, I want to highlight that because this is going to be really important for some of the other conversations in the rest of the day. And that is a catch-all. I'll tell you right now, it's not enough money, but it is a start. It recognizes that there's an importance for board priorities, items that the board directs policy and CEMER to undertake. For example, Type F, I think, is going to be a big one. Unstable slopes, both of those are the two that I can see right now out of the gate are going to be important. We've identified those as important in the budget for 2017. I think that's only going to be more important as the permanent rule, as we get to a permanent rule. And so I just wanted to point that out as a placeholder. And then we get to this report to the legislature, and that was an item that we put in earlier in this biennium as kind of a requirement that we have at the end of the biennium. Okay. And so in total, that first group sums to $1.527 million. That's the piece for those elements. Then we get to projects that are near completion. And these are projects that are well on their way, occurring right now. Many of them are going to be coming to conclusion. Actually, all of them are going to be completed in the biennium there. And those sum up to $744,000. And it is important to note that these are approximate costs because there are some, these unforeseen things that happen. And then sometimes we save money in projects. In fact, more often I would say than not, we actually end up saving money. So that's another challenge that sometimes we have to make sure that we have projects teed up where we can keep things moving forward, as Mark Hicks mentioned earlier. Okay, then we get into projects that are in field implementation. You'll see NREP is in there. I'm hopeful that NREP is going to be in field implementation in the next biennium. I'm doing everything that I can, and I'm working with people like Mark and senior leadership, Todd Baldwin and Doug Hooks, to try to get that that dispute resolved, try to keep this thing going, get this project, make the improvements that we can, figure out solutions to the dispute, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's the intent, is that project, we've got to get that thing going. No more excuses. Okay, then we talked about the twigs. You'll see the twigs highlighted there.
Excuse me, Hans. Yeah. Is NREP clean water?
Yes.
Priority?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thanks.
So then we go through these twigs. We're working on those projects now. They're in study design phase primarily. We talked about the unstable slopes twig earlier. Mark brought it up. That twig is slow. We're going to need to make some changes to the composition of that group. We have some members that aren't performing, and we just can't afford that. And so it is my intent that project is also going to be in the field implementation phase in the next biennium. So all of this planning, all this work that's been going on now, we're gonna make those things happen in the next biennium. So those are the total there. And as you can imagine, those are the big ticket items, obviously. And so the total estimated cost for the projects and field implementation for the next biennium is just over $3 million. So these are, these are big projects. Really good, thorough studies. And then we get to the projects that are in study design, conceptual stages. Those are the things that are going to be planned, more or less implemented in the next biennium, unless something changes, which we don't foresee at the moment. And those projects, there's a whole variety of things. There's glacial deep-seated strategy execution, there's a bunch of wetlands projects, there's some roads, or actually those aren't for the next biennium, but then there's the amphibians and intermittent streams that Mark Hicks talked about, that's on there, you'll see in 2019. And then some of those projects that are on the list for in study design and conceptual, they're out in future years. It's important that they're captured on the list because if we see funding opportunities or project opportunities, we've got them on our list, we're thinking about them. If something happens, if there's a shortfall in funding or if we have extra money, we'll make adjustments there and we'll try to get those projects initiated maybe sooner. That would be the ideal situation. We can find elements of those projects like scoping or literature review or some of those things to really put a little more flesh on the bone, so to speak, and get those things getting going. And so the total there is for the entire biennium is estimated at $1.1 million. And so in summary, the debt management program seeks to spend about $8 million during the 17-19 biennium to implement the applied research projects. With all of our assumptions, with general fund state and of course forest and fish support account, etc., we think that after the biennium, and with some ability to move the forest and fish support account from one fiscal year to the next, which is highlighted in cell B43, you'll see that in the end of the first biennium, we think that we are going to have about $362,000 left over, and that money will be available to carry forward into the 2019 fiscal year. And then we have some places where that money will be spent. And after everything's said and done, with the current projection that we have, with all of the caveats that go with current projections that are more or less 3 years out from now, we think we're gonna overspend by about $12,000. That's
and you're not actually
we will not overspend by a penny, but with all of the assumptions, that's where we forecast. So essentially it's zero. And again, this budget was approved by policy with one exception. We approved it on the fly, and there was an item for the CEMER science staff. There's a little bit of uncertainty about some positions that are open right now there, and so the question is whether or not we could spend it. And in consultation with the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission on that particular topic, they'll definitely have both of those positions filled before that. So the number was off by $50,000 in fiscal year 2018. That was the only change that was made from the policy approved document. And as you can imagine, when you're going through spreadsheets on a projector in real time making adjustments to balance budgets, there are some nuances there that end up and rounding and so forth, so we ended up just slightly off there, but that's the proposed budget. And it's also important to note that at this time we do not see any point or any necessity in seeking additional funds from the legislature, just like I mentioned back in May. I think we need to focus on what we have and make sure that we are wise in how we use the money that we're currently working under in our current allotment appropriation.
Questions from the board? Board member Spohr.
Thanks, Hans. Just trying to think of how to say this. So of the projects that we know of that have been identified as priorities, we should either be able to find them with funding in next biennium or in some of the out years. Are there other issues out there that didn't end up on the list in either of those places?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. In fiscal year 2016, we went through a process of at CEMER and updating the work plan. And in doing that, we looked at projects that were below the line from previous years in the budget and looked at opportunities and current issues that had been brought up. There were a number of those forest chemicals is one example, but some related to mass wasting as well. And there were a number of, and also fire, wildfire potential studies in forest health. And so there were a number of things that were brought up as being important. And it went through a process at CMER in approving those and making those recommendations. And those prioritized projects were brought to policy. But when we looked at the budget and we considered the capacity that we have in the program, both with stakeholders, project managers, senior science staff, and this list of things that we are not getting done, rather than take those items on for this biennium, the decision was made and the recommendation was made, which I think is wise, to consider those for the next biennium and work out the details this biennium to make sure that they are really ready. So there are some other projects that and some ideas that are being kicked around as important, but they just don't have the enough information to really justify either taking things off or adjusting budgets to get them on the list.
So 2 years from now, there's another list that doesn't appear here that would be looked at and prioritized along with the projects that you're projecting here?
Yes. Those projects would be for consideration of getting on the master project schedule. When they're on the master project schedule, it's our responsibility to make sure that they happen and look at the sequencing and with our best information provided to the board on how we can get those things done. And right now, there wasn't, we didn't see a place for those to fall.
Thank you.
So my suggestion, Hans, to as the Adaptive Management Program Administrator and to policy would be that when you bring us a budget to adopt next May, that you have the what we fondly call the hold list so that people can, the board members can see the whole potential list. Especially since I think both you and Mark mentioned that you, CMER, have just gone through and taken a look at that whole list to identify priorities and so forth for the future. And it'd probably be more appropriate next spring because you may want to have some of those sort of in the offing in case either projects don't go as expected or you end up with a few extra dollars to spend.
Yeah, I expect that between now and May, there's going to be some scrubbing of numbers, some discussions about those projects, and the compelling case is going to need to be made to add something, and it would come to the board in May if that case is made. But I fully expect that. We're working on the work plan for January at CMER. And so if there is that opportunity to identify something or if the board identifies something that's a priority, we would make sure to bring that before we get the appropriation.
Hey, board members, please.
Yeah, I just want to clarify when you said that you don't think we have to go to the legislature for more money. So the big push that we did
two years ago,
right? So that appropriated enough money, and that there's not even a need to go ask for a reauthorization. It's just like we're done with having to go talk to them for a while.
So maybe I should take part of that question. So as you know, we have two pieces to fund the research and monitoring program: the forest and fish support count, which is a surcharge on the B&O tax from the timber industry that builds up to about $4 million per year and then gets shut off, assuming it gets to $4 million. So, and then on top of that, we have the general fund state money we requested 2 years ago. That money in this last session, part of it, because of the fund balance, of course, the fish support account, they switched out $1.1 million because we had a fund balance that we didn't anticipate, and so, but we still have that didn't change the total appropriation that we have available to spend on these projects, and so, and those all become annualized in the new biennial budget as a starting point for the budget process. Any other questions from board members on the proposed budget? Hans, you want to go over the proposed outline for the legislative report?
Sure. So I think I'll have a copy here. The purpose of this report is it's specifically in the substitute House Bill 2376, pages 173 and 174, and that comes back, it includes the fund shift that House Chairman Van Aff talked about. And so it really, in the direct quote is, "The Forest Practices Board shall submit a report to the legislature following review, approval, and solicitation of public comment on the CMER science and related adaptive management expenditure details and accomplishments, the use of cooperative monitoring, evaluation of research science and decision making, and funding needs for the coming biennium. The report shall be provided to the appropriate committees of the legislature on October 1, 2016. And so this report is really just to fulfill that obligation. And so the outline of the report is to focus on the master project schedule, to identify the CMER research and talk about what the purpose of CMER research is, in a very brief and concise way. List the topical areas of the projects. We're looking at wetlands, we're looking at roads, we're looking at unstable slopes, for example, and type in waters, riparian effectiveness projects. And then identify what the proposed budgets are, the timelines for completion, and what we expect to accomplish in the biennium. And again, this is for the current biennium. And keep in mind that we're only through the first fiscal year. So in my mind, it seems a little premature, but nevertheless, it is what it is. And then talk about what was reviewed and adopted by the Forest Practices Board a year ago for this biennium. So we're looking backwards in a way for this report. Then we talk about the expenditure details, ongoing projects. It's important, I think, to point out that these ongoing projects, because of the nature of the work that we do, they do straddle across bienniums. And so that's an important consideration in getting things done and sequenced it appropriately. At the end of this biennium, as Mark Hicks said, we're going to finish a huge study that we've been doing on the type end hard rock study in the salt ecologies, looking at buffer prescriptions, and that was presented at the CMER Science Seminar last year. And so we'll talk about the complexity of those projects, then talk about new projects that we've initiated in this biennium, and then talk about the number of projects that are on the schedule that started before the biennium, the number of projects that were initiated and what was completed specifically. And then we'll talk about the amount of proviso, general fund, state that were expended, so all of our expenditures, which we're just getting those numbers now. And then we're going to talk about the funds outside of the proviso. And as Chairman Burnett said, the FFSA is a huge piece of what we do. It really is the backbone here of the program, so it's important to recognize that. And we'll talk about the accomplishments, the number of projects completed, what we expect to complete in the next biennium, and then go into the use of science and decision making, and really what it comes down to, the decision making happens here. And so as the projects come forward, in my mind, from CMER through policy, the end of the road is here. And that can result in a no decision, which I think is an important milestone, as well as if changes are needed. But anything like that would happen here, and so that's the focus there. Let's see, and then focusing on our funding needs for the 17-19 biennium, and that, like I just mentioned, we are going to be requesting the same funding level as the previous. We utilize the FFSA to make the difference.
And then there's going to be important board-directed research surrounding fish-bearing streams and unstable slopes, clean water act assurances. Those are the places that I see as the primary focus of the next biennium. Those are the areas of uncertainty. Those are the areas where we really need to get the science right, make sure that what is being provided to the board is going to be helpful in your decision-making process. And then as attachments, I was going to attach this master project schedule that I just presented to you, as well as the previous one that you approved.
Questions from board members? Thank you. Okay.
We are scheduled for a short break.
Are we ready for that? Or do we want to push ahead?
Keep going?
All right, let's take public comment on the master project schedule and the proposed budget and the legislative report. Patricia, do we have people signed up? Doug Hooks, please.
Chair Banath, members of the board. My name is Doug Hooks from the Washington Forest Protection Association and also serving as senior co-chair. I think Hans and Stephen have done a great job of describing the decision in front of you today. I just wanted to add a little bit of perspective from the senior vantage point. So this has been a new process as we've gone through trying to develop our master project schedule. As Stephen said before, it was kind of around the settlement agreement and Clean Water Act assurances. CEMER's been in a situation now where we're expected to look at what we're doing in years 18 and 19, and some of these projects aren't even yet scoped. And so it's been a challenge for folks to actually come up with good guesses as to what those costs may be. So as we're in this situation right now, this year you're just doing a budget approval, or excuse me, a budget request. Next year we'll be doing the approval. I do expect some of those numbers to change. So there's the flexibility and the adaptability that Hans just described to you before that is needed within the program in order for us to be able to spend all the money. So it's been a clunky process, and I think there could be some better exchange of information between CEMER and policy as to what the projects are intended to do, and we've gotten there over time as we've worked through this. But I'd like to still continue to see that improve. Another thing that you mentioned, as you were kind of hearing from Mark in his report on the Clean Water Act assurances, Hans and I and Todd are doing our best to try and keep projects moving and to follow the timelines that we're at. We are dealing with a lot of people and a lot of issues there. We are trying to look at our lean process to look at the ones that are coming through there, the five projects that are working through that are hopefully beginning to study design and implementation during this time period. We're also looking at how we can efficiently bring the studies that are coming back to us that are produced, such as the Hard Rock study, which also meets some of the Clean Water Act assurances, and efficiently deliver that to policy and then ultimately to the board. I also want to make you aware that, as you know, these numbers are flexible and are changes, and as Hans has mentioned, there is only a very minimal amount in this master project schedule allotted for board priorities. Any changes that you do make to that, there is a cap to what we have. So if you increase that amount of money, then money has to come from something else which can compete with other Clean Water Act assurances or other people's priorities. So I guess I urge you to please approve the budget as it is. And I guess lastly, the legislative report, I didn't hear it explicitly mentioned in the outline, but just to continue to stress the importance of the funding. And I mean, we're not asking for a decision package or having to go above the request, but just to stress how important that funding is for the completion of all of our Clean Water Act priorities and the success of the program. Thank you.
Doug. Okay. Patricia, do you have a draft motion for the board, please? Could I have a motion, please? One of the board members. Board Member Stanley.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll have to fix that.
Yeah. I move the Forest Practice Board approve the 2017-2019 CEMER Master Project Schedule and estimated budget as presented.
Second.
Board Member Lori seconded the motion. Any discussion? Please, let's vote. Everybody in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Any abstentions? Thank you. The motion passes. I'll ask the board. If you're comfortable with the outline of the legislative report we put together, I can work with staff and submit that legislative report to the legislature on your behalf. If you are in agreement with that, we can. That would be much appreciated, or we can put it in writing with the motion.
I'm in agreement with that. If we need a motion, let's do it. If not, just go ahead.
Is there a staff recommendation?
Let's go with it.
Okay. Staff is saying we should. Well, would you put it up there, please, then?
What happens?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. Okay. I move the Forest Practices Board approve the outline presented today for the preparation of the report for the legislature on FY 2015-2017 funding for the implementation of the Cooperative Monitoring Evaluation Research and Adaptive Management Program expenditures as required by Second and Gross Substitute House Bill 2376. I further move the board direct staff to complete the report and submit it to the appropriate legislative committees by October 1st, 2016, on behalf of the board.
I'll second. Thank you, Board Member Gunther. Any discussion? Board Member Jack.
Let me just be clarification, Chairman, but the recommendation from Doug Cook about the including, not assuming that the legislature will know that we're really asking for continuation of funding, is that an appropriate addition to that outline? And the reason, I have a second part to that question, which is we earlier talked about the old list of projects that I assume funding is the construction on why some of those things just aren't their bandwidth of the group right now. So is it worthwhile to demonstrate backlog, unfunded backlog, in a report like this so that they don't go looking for ways to reduce funding?
Budget cuts? Is that what you're trying to say?
I don't want to be a McClary victim. I'm financial. I always want, I want to make sure that the financial ask is clear at each level.
I see Patricia is. Patricia perhaps and project funding needs through 2030? Because that's what the projection of this budget actually does. Would that meet your need?
It doesn't have all those things that you're not that we're not currently covering. And maybe that isn't the right place to include it, but I guess that's why I'm bringing up this discussion.
So can I maybe offer clarification to what you're suggesting? Is maybe adding some discussion of the the need to continue funding into the future in order to be able to accomplish the projects that are described out to 2030. Just if what I hear being asked for is just a positive statement of, in the absence of continued funding in the future, we won't be able to accomplish the same.
So what I would suggest, that doesn't necessarily require a change in the motion, but it does, if Hans can acknowledge, he will add that to the outline. That we're gonna,
yes, and I think in item six, you know, a addition of an item D that would focus on out to 2030, the means for, you know, funding all the way out to 2030, that might be a good place for that.
But your other point is that we also have a list that you don't see even going out to 2030 that may not be funded at this time.
So we'll add it.
Okay. Yes?
Delete.
And project funding needs, I would just say out to 2030, because that's what the budget actually does. Is that a friendly amendment? Does that work for the movers and seconders?
Fine with me.
I have a clarification question there, because I thought what you were saying was also a good point, but I understood it to be that there are a bunch of projects that we could be doing if we had more money. Which
correct.
Is, I think, okay.
Correct.
Is that what you're?
What I'm trying to capture both the need to that we have commitments out to 2030, and Hans is going to capture in the outline the fact that this isn't a complete list. Correct,
right.
Hans?
Right. Yeah, I'm writing that down.
Does that satisfy your question? Great. Thank you. Any other discussion from board members? All right. Let's vote on this. All in favor of the motion as presented on the, as amended on the screen, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any, anybody against? Same sign. Abstentions? Thank you very much. The motion passes. All right, we're moving right along here. Hans gets to stay up here. We're going to start the discussion and see how far we go here on the TFW Policy Committee's recommendations and timelines on the Institute of Source Proposal Initiation. So just as a reminder, you know, the board adopted new versions of the board manual 16 four times over the last 2 years. One of those updates took place at the November meeting of last year. The board, in addition, agreed to, after some significant feedback from stakeholders, to ask the board manual 16 committee to complete those items that were near resolution, hence the approval of the changes to the board manual in May, and asked staff to develop an adaptive management pathway for the rest of the items. In February, the proposal for the adaptive management path was accepted, and we've been waiting for the AMPA the adaptive management program administrator response and a corresponding response from TFW policy. Hans will take us through the policy's recommendations and timeline.
Okay. So what happened following the board meeting in February was the direction to me to follow up on the proposal initiation that was the board's. And so I presented that to policy in a memo dated 31 March 2016, and policy has been deliberating what to do with the recommendations for the six items in my recommended track to address the board's proposal initiation. After several months of discussions, a subgroup was formed. They got together, they looked at it, and they put together a first phase, is how I would describe it, because it does not cover all of the elements in your proposal initiation. That's the first point to make. It covers several of them. And these were some things that were brought to policy at the last meeting. We can have to go. They were approved by policy unanimously, consensus. And those items are for topic. I'll just list them by topic. There are three topics here. The first one is the one that has some financial implications, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And that is to look at potential instability and failure mechanisms of deep-seated landslides. So earlier we had worked on glacial deep-seated slides, and these are for the non-glacial deep-seated landslides. And so following what I had recommended in my approach for the PI is to conduct a literature review within 8 months to address questions related to the mechanics of non-glacial deep-seated landslides, failures and reactivation, and the impacts of worst practices on the same. And the thought there is that it's going to cost probably around $80,000. We just did one of these literature reviews. It's a science track. There's a number of questions that they have related to groundwater recharge areas, reactivation potential, complex composite deep-seated slide behavior, and runout. And those would be accomplished pretty quickly. We would go out to a contract for bid and get going on that pretty quickly. Okay, so that's topic one. Topic number two relates to terminology related to reactivation potential of relict versus dormant deep-seated landslides. And part of the issue there is really a technical definition, and there are some very specific technical elements there. And the recommendation that I made was that this could be something that UPSAG, unstable slopes, or upslope processes, scientific advisory group of CEMER couldn't just deal with. This is a technical issue. It's completely resolvable. I think a discussion would be healthy and useful. And it may be a recommendation that there are some definitions that are a little more explicit about what is meant by some of those, some of the jargon there. And so I think that's a pretty simple thing. There's no financial implications. That's just something that UPSAG should do. What policy would like is for UPSAG to report back to policy in October 2016 on what was decided. And so UPSAG meets once a month. They have a meeting in August and another one in September. They can put this on the agenda. They can spend some time around it and deal with it. This is the same approach that I recommended as well. And then topic number three is to scope the potential for empirically based runout risk screening tools for shallow rapid rule identified landforms identification and analysis. And the recommended action here is to ask CEMER, which would really be UPSAG as the experts there, to propose a way to address the issue and report what that way or path forward would be to policy within 3 months. So it's not to develop a scope or a study or anything like that, or to come up with an answer, but it's just to propose how you would approach that. And that also doesn't have a cost yet associated with it. And so what I wanted to do very quickly as a follow-up, so you're aware, in the 2016 and adjusted 2017 budgets that you approved back in May, we had a placeholder for board priorities, and unstable slopes and type F were called out specifically. For fiscal year 2017, that item is $328,271. It was the balance that we had included without using it. And have at the end. So that we do have money during this fiscal year set aside to focus on type F and unstable slopes issues. So that $80,000 item that is not in the budget, was not part of anything because it came through proposal initiation, there is an off-ramp for that. We do have the funds available to do that first body of work that policy is ready.
Questions from the board for Hans? Okay. Patricia, do we have people sign up for public comment on this? Carl Whitaker, please.
Good morning, Chairman Bernath and board members. My name is Carl Whitaker. I'm the senior scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus. The Conservation Caucus is pleased that the Policy Committee has made its initial set of recommendations and proposed a timeline on the tasks outlined in the Unstable Slopes proposal initiation. The three initial topics that Hans just described that policy is asking UPSEG to address are imperative for ensuring forest practices are not increasing threats to public resources or safety. For example, a comprehensive literature review evaluating what is known about the mechanics and effects of forest practices on non-glacial and complex deep-seated landslide reactivation, reactivation and runout will help fill a significant gap in our understanding. Having just completed a similar literature review on glacial deep-seated landslides, UPSEG is poised to broaden the scope of the inquiry and generate additional recommendations for further study where the best available science has been inconclusive thus far. Second, an assessment by UPSEG of the reactivation potential of deep-seated landslides presumed to be dormant or relict is also of utmost importance. For instance, the board manual currently implies that relict and dormant indistinct glacial deep-seated landslides cannot be reactivated by changes in the groundwater budget associated with timber harvest, and it does not recommend further qualitative or quantitative analyses of the reactivation potential, nor an assessment of the delivery potential or threat to public safety of these types of landslides. In practice, this leads to routine harvest of relict and dormant indistinct glacial deep-seated landslides and their groundwater recharge areas, regardless of the potential impacts to public safety and resources. A robust assessment of the third topic of potential shallow landslide runout tools by UPSEG is necessary to ensure runout distances are being assessed consistently among general practitioners and qualified experts. For example, observed shallow rapid landslide runout distances can be assumed and expected runout distances in similar hydrogeologic settings. If runout distance and the potential to deliver or threaten public safety are underestimated, then a rural-identified landform may be harvested despite its true hazard. As UPSEG's newest member, I'm happy to report that we anticipate revising our overall deep-seated landslide research strategy in response to the science tasks in the proposal initiation, as recommended by policy. The Conservation Caucus urges the board to please approve policy's recommendations and timeline for these initial steps of the proposal initiation. We anticipate policy's response to the remaining tasks and look forward to continuing our work together on these important questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Cara. Karen Twilliger, please.
Good morning, Chair Bernath and members of the Forest Practices Board. For the record, my name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the Senior Forester with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and I'm here today in support of this motion or this proposal that's been brought forward. The way that we developed this proposal and policy is that Mary Scurlock from the Conservation Caucus, Mark Engel from Department of Natural Resources, and I sat down with the proposal initiation, as well as Hans's response to that proposal, and came up with these three items that we thought were the initial attack on this issue because of the pieces that need to go through science. There are some other elements of the proposal initiation that are more policy oriented, and we really need some time to think about how we would address some of those questions. So I was going to go through the three points of consensus, but Hans did a fantastic job. So in the interest of time, I will not do that. Commend to you the proposal as well as the commitment to continue the work on this issue. This is part of the adaptive management process. when somebody brings forward an issue that may not have the appropriate or the science around it that needs to be there in order for something to be in a board manual or in a rule, the next step is to put it through the science process. So I think that this is a very important step forward for you. With that, if you have questions, I'm open. Yes, no?
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks.
All right. Could you flip the motion up on the projector, please?
Break.
You need a break? Am I hearing the staff needs a break? Okay, can we make it a short break?
Yes.
How about 10 minutes and so that we can get through this before lunch?
Thank you. I like what you're saying too.